This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle station.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my ever-genial co-host, the inestimable Eagle One of Eagle Speak. We appreciate you joining us here for 2022's inaugural edition of Midrats, which incidentally... believe it or not, kids, this is going to be our 13th year doing the podcast. We've been doing the podcast so long that when it first started, we had to tell people it was a national security and maritime-related talk show because nobody knew what a podcast was. So better or worse, here we are going into our 13th year, and we're going to kick it off in great style. And if you're with us live, I'd like to invite you to go ahead and go to the chat room at the bottom of the show page. It's up and running. And we've got everybody's favorite Cal there welcoming you on the quarterdeck as you step across. That's the great place during the course of the show. If you have some observations you would like to share or if there are some questions you would like to direct to our guests, we'll be glad to go ahead and roll that into the conversation. And remember, everybody, if you've got to go take care of some business and you can't listen to the full hour, you can go ahead and get the podcast over on iTunes, Spreaker, or whatever place you get your podcast from. And so this episode and other episodes will be waiting for you when you get there. And on to today's show. And we have on for the full hour, he's a historian, an intel officer, a teacher, a staff weenie, a mainer, and the best friend of the show we have, Dr. Claude Barrabay, returning again. And we're going to talk today about his latest and his fourth nonfiction book titled On Wide Seas, The United States Navy in the Jacksonian Era, that was just released by University of Alabama Press. And if you care about American history in general and U.S. Navy in particular, you've really decided to spend an hour at the right place. Claude, welcome back to Midrats and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, guys, and congratulations on 12 full years of the show. It's, you know, I always tell people it's the C-SPAN for the Navy because you look at issues in depth and you look at them over time. And thanks for all the time that you have put in these past 12 years, and I wish you many more.
Well, thank you very much, Claude. And with guests like we've had from you during the year, hopefully we've helped move the ball forward a little bit in understanding some of the issues that are addressing us today. And that was, you know, one of the fun things about reading your book, besides the fact I can tell people, hey, I know the author, is most good accounts of history, as you're reading it, you can find that connection from what happened 20 years ago, 200 years ago, 2,000 years ago. And you can see that direct connection to issues that people are seeing now, that they're experiencing now. You see personalities, you see storylines. You see that connection where whenever somebody says this is unprecedented or nobody's ever seen this before, this is a new issue that everybody needs to stop what they're doing and examine, that you go, no, not really. If you've had a chance to read enough that's well written, that you can, you know, probably save yourself some time, money, and maybe effort by going, hey, people have seen this in the past, and this was their response. You know, what could we learn from what they did before? And Claude, that's one of the things that people are going to see on Wide Seas as they read it. And in the pre-show, my co-host mentioned the fact, and it's true, that one of the frustrating things about reading the book is that it encouraged you to go do initial research. It's like, that's a real neat-looking rabbit hole. Claude can't write a 1,000-page book, so I'm going to go do some other research and dive down into it. And I guess as an opening question, what I wanted to roll your way is one of the attractive rabbit holes I went down. Now, as a unalloyed Southerner whose family's been south of the Mason-Dixon for the better part of four centuries, I live and swim in Jackson. You can't go anywhere without there being almost every state in the Southeast has a Jackson or a Jacksonville. There are counties, cities. He's written all over the place. When you look at the country writ large, when you look at what presidents have counties, any type of civil division or towns named after them, as you would expect, the father of our country, Washington's number one. It's also no surprise that Lincoln is number two, the man that kept the Union back together. And at number three is Jackson. And yet you found an opportunity, an area to explore about Jackson, specifically his relationship and, you know, building this new nation's Navy, that is a relatively unexplored area of scholarship. It's good. Just take a minute about that opportunity and why you think it's, you know, we had to wait till Claude Berube in 2022 to really decide, I'm going to dive into this in detail.
Sure. It, you know, like the Grateful Dead song, What a Long, Strange Road It's Been. When I started my dissertation on which this book is based, I was actually doing something else. It was on Anglo-American naval relations prior to World War II. And there were 50 boxes of this one admiral at Naval History and Heritage Command that I was going to get it to. I just needed to do secondary research. And I get there finally, and I ask for access. And they say, sorry, but everything's classified under the Kyle Laud Amendment. And I say, well, you know, how would I get access to it? And they said, well, we don't have time to do it. We need to find somebody who has a clearance, and we need to have somebody who has time. I said, well, you know, I'm a reservist and you have a reserve unit. I could pop over here at no cost to you and I've got a clearance. I can look through them. And she just sort of looked at me and said, no, I'm sorry, we can't accommodate you. I was like, okay. So I had to find a new topic. And my first book was on Commodore Charles Stewart. And I'd written a little bit about him during the 1830s. And it was kind of this black hole in naval history. Not a lot of people had written about it. There were elements here and there. Dudley Knox in the 1940s, when he writes his History of the United States Navy, he talks briefly about this being a period of protecting and promoting sea trade, using force when necessary. In the 60s, when Harold and Margaret Sprout write The Rise of American Naval Power, they mention Jackson, and they say, well, you know, he possibly had some conception of the strategic doctrine of the command of the seas. And then in the 1980s, John Schroeder, who was a professor in Wisconsin, writes a book and specifically a chapter on Jackson's naval policy. And he says, you know, that there really isn't that much out there. And I met with John early on. He was a visiting professor at the Naval Academy, and I chatted with him about it. But it really wasn't until – so I needed a dissertation topic. And I said, I'm going to explore this 1830s thing. And when I met with Robert Remini, arguably the foremost historian of the Jacksonian era, who wrote about 15 or 16 books on it, met with him when he was historian of the House of Representatives, and I just said, you know, what's your bottom line view on Jackson and the Navy? And he said, Claude, it comes down to this. Jackson didn't like the Navy, he didn't understand the Navy, and he didn't use the Navy. And we had a wonderful chat for about an hour, a wonderful gentleman. But I really started from there. I said, okay, well, what exactly is going on in the 1830s? And I started saying, wait a minute, you've got the development of steam power. You've got this new schoolish idea. You've got officers talking to each other. So as I started to unravel it, it's as you said, it was a rabbit hole that I went down basically just on a few lines. It was very similar to when I was taking a Naval War College course, and I came across one line in the book about how the Office of Strategic Services helped Ho Chi Minh in 1945, and then that evolved into two full articles for Vietnam Magazine. So really, I think dissertations and books arise out of those rabbit holes. Getting to your baseline question of why hasn't there been more written about this, I think people tend to gravitate toward the wars, World War II, Spanish-American War, War of 1812, because there's a lot of quote-unquote action there. I thought it was just important to understand the Navy during peacetime, largely peacetime operations, because there's so much out there. There is the organization that you see in any decade. There is there's the budgets. What's going on? How are they investing their money? So that's really where this book came from.
You know, years ago on my blog, I put up a post about U.S. Navy action against some pirates in the melee, I guess, in the melee area, mm-hmm. And that is mentioned in your book, and it brought to mind. As I was reading your book, I'm going, well, this Jackson, what he's talking about when he's dealing with the Navy is he's anticipating Mahan. I mean. Yeah. Everything he talks about as you go through the book, and I'd like you to discuss that, is that, you know, he's why do we need a Navy? Because commerce, and how do we protect commerce, mm-hmm. and all that stuff. So kind of go through that. I mean, how much anticipation, how much did Mahan come along later on and say, you know, Jackson had the right idea, but, you know, he did use the Navy, and he did use it to protect civilian shipping and assets, and he had a goal in mind. Can you kind of discuss that?
Sure, and I'm going to start off with just very briefly with what you're referring to in the attack on the French ship, a merchant ship in 1831 in Gualapatu and Sumatra. And for your listeners, I mean, everybody knows B.J. Armstrong. I'd strongly recommend his book, Small Boat, Daring Men. That really goes into this. It's where the first mate and some of the crew are killed, and the ship, John Downs on the frigate Potomac is ordered to the area, but Jackson orders them to, number one, demand restitution, hold criminals accountable, and only warn of a future force down the road. Downs ends up attacking the fort and the town. But this goes again to the conversation with Robert Remini, and he specifically talks about this incident, and he said, this is Jackson being Jackson. He sees an offense and he responds with military force. So I took that and I took a step back and I started looking at the incidents in which he uses force or doesn't use force. And keep in mind, as you alluded to regarding Mahan, he had a maritime strategy and it was comprised of three components. Number one, expand trade wherever you can. He is negotiating with the Ottoman Empire. He is negotiating with the Russians so he can have access to the wheat in the Black Sea. And if you want to see an early 20th century version of that, I'd recommend Nick Lambert's book on Gallipoli. So expand trade. But when you expand trade, how are you doing trade at that point? It is primarily from merchant ships, as largely it is now. But he says, number two, you've got to protect merchant ships. You've got to have a Navy that is primarily a coastal defense, but provides forward presence, not intervention. And third, respond when necessary with that Navy. So as you look at the naval incidents that occur during his administration, you have this civil war in Portugal between the liberals and the Miguelites. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly. Miguelites, 1828 to 1834. The Azores, the island chain that is controlled by Portugal, is blockaded. U.S. commerce is attacked in 1830. The U.S. demands reparations. Portuguese kick back. Jackson says, hey, I've authorized a squadron. I'm sending it. Well, what happens? Portugal doesn't want to deal with an American squadron in addition to all of the European powers, so they honor the reparations. A second incident, the Falklands. What was then called the United Provinces, that was, I think, Argentina, Uruguay, and I think one other country, has this guy in the Falklands named Louis Vernet, who wanted a portion of what the merchant ships were getting, and these are sealers and whalers. And so he starts arresting American ships and crew. Jackson finds out about this, sends the USS Lexington, lands Marines. But at no point does Jackson lay blame on Buenos Aires, the capital of the United Provinces, because, again, he's interested in his trade. So he isolates the problem and resolves the problem. Another incident, a Samoan island, a Nantucket whaler is attacked. Some of the crew survived. The local captain on station ends up burning the village in 1834, but Jackson doesn't send more people because, again, it doesn't matter to him. 1835, New Bedford whaler, the Washunks, goes to the Marshall Islands. Again, the captain and crew are killed, but there's no punitive raid, and so why is this? And this is not according to what Remini was telling me. Jackson only uses force when he absolutely has to, and with these small islands, they were inconsequential to trade for him. So he didn't have to do anything. He's actually very judicious when it comes to use of force. When, however, it comes to the larger powers, England, France, even to some degree Mexico, Jackson is very reluctant to use force because he understands he doesn't have the capability. In the case of France, there was some major diplomatic negotiations going on about, I think it was 25 million francs that had to be repaid by France for earlier in the century. And there are people proposing war with France around 1835, including James Fenimore Cooper, who, you know, we all know as the author of Last of the Mohegans. But Cooper was one of the early navalists. He writes a naval history of the United States. He writes articles, and he's proposing this. But Jackson never takes on somebody who's bigger than him. And then I did this after the book came out because I honestly just didn't think about it. I looked at his battles. If you look at the Battle of Horseshoe Bend, where he gets into Horseshoe Bend because he outnumbers the enemy 3-1. In the Battle of New Orleans, yeah, he's outnumbered. I think it was about – he had about 6,000, and the British had more or less about 8,000. But he had extremely firm defensive positions in New Orleans. So Jackson isn't the person that we started hearing – or I shouldn't say started hearing about – in the last presidential administration because of the president's affinity with Jackson. Jackson's not some psychotic guy who's using violence all the time. I want to – and allow me to qualify that for just a moment. I am not writing about Jackson and his treatment of American Indians or anybody else. I am focused on the Navy and how he was using the Navy. His treaties with the Indians, those are well documented with Remini and others. In fact, again, getting to your other point, Eagle One, I don't think actually, I'm going to stop there, and I'll let you guys go ahead. Sorry.
No problem at all. It's easy to dive down. After I found myself doing the same thing, like the Battle of Horseshoe Bend. That's one of my favorite undertold stories. And interesting, especially when people start talking about the interaction with Native Americans at that time. Battle of Horseshoe Bend, most of the forces were actually, I think they were the Upper Creek, were Native Americans, and they actually came up with the battle plan to attack the other group. But different story for a different day. But you brought up the Battle of New Orleans, and you know. Full disclosure, my family fought with him at the Battle of New Orleans as part of the Mississippi Dragoons and the militia company that came from our county. Anyway, but he was an Army officer, and he was known for ground combat, but there was a lot of things that we're going to talk, we've done a little bit now, and I'm sure we'll hit on for the rest of the hour, about his role in transitioning the Navy into the rough outlines of the modern form that we had today. But he wasn't somebody who just discovered the Navy and naval issues or he handed it over to somebody else. New Orleans was one of them, but there were three big influences that you mention in the book about the Navy and naval technology that he was exposed to before he came into the office. What were those three little foundational?
Sure. And as we all know, I mean, we can be very much influenced by things that happened in our childhood. And when he was very young, he lost his mother in Charleston. She was tending to the wounded and to those who were ill on the British ships in Charleston. And he sees this. That's his first, at least visual connection with the British Navy and a large Navy at that. The second time is during the Battle of New Orleans. You've got Thomas A.P. Catesby Jones with some of the boats on the lake, and also getting support from a steamboat named, appropriately, the Enterprise. The third time is during his inauguration. I really didn't know anything about Jackson's inauguration until I got to this and I read a local history. It turns out that for most of the journey from his home, he took a steamboat, about 75% of his journey. So here he is. He becomes familiar with the importance of trade on the rivers, the use of steamboats, and he will actually order. He's the first president. Excuse me. I should qualify this. Steamboat, the Seagull, had been used before in David Porter's squadron. But during the Second Seminole War, Jackson specifically orders three steamboats down to Florida to support Army operations to be used by the Navy. And the reason I found this, because I worked for a couple of senators, so I was familiar with the Center for Legislative Archives at National Archives. And I was looking through all these committee reports, which people tend to look at the congressional record, what was said, but I found these orders coming directly from Jackson to the Navy about employing steam technology for major military operations. And I want to go back just a moment to something that Eagle wanted asked about to tie this all in. I think one of the reasons why somebody like Robert Remini or some of the other historians, but especially Remini, didn't talk about the Navy or he made these assumptions is that he didn't look at the sources. I went back through all of his books and I couldn't find anything where he had gone into the records of the Department of the Navy. That's not a fault of his. As a historian, you can't search everything. But I think his assessment was based on Jackson and who he knew as a president, as a president who dealt with those treaties with Native Americans, president who did so many other things. That's why I think that Remini was wrong, and I wish I would have been able to have a follow-up conversation with him prior to his passing to just understand that a little more.
Yeah, this your book was so full of rabbit holes for me. I mean, we need to get to it at some point, but you were just talking about the Navy and the Seminole Wars with the steamships. But when I went down that rabbit hole, I know more about the Seminole Wars than I ever thought I would now. But one of the other things that Jackson did, and I think this is foundational to show how much of a navalist he really was the infrastructure. He under his watch built up quite an infrastructure for the United States Navy. Could you talk about that?
Sure. Probably the most important thing was the continuation of the Norfolk dry dock. It represents a major investment. And keep in mind, when he comes to office, people don't think of him as a navalist, but he actually continues a number of the projects that John Quincy Adams had. He will end up building 17 ships out of the 91 that were built between 1798 and 1837. That doesn't count Jefferson's gunboats, obviously. Jackson will build – now, I had to pull the paper on this one to make sure I got the numbers right. Between 1798 and 1837, the country builds 2.3 ships on average annually. Jackson, in his 8 years, 2.1 on average. However, if you take away the wartime presidents, the wartime years, during peacetime, the Navy only builds 1.4 ships per year. Jackson, 2.1. So here's a guy who's investing much more into that. And what you end up seeing is not only that dry dock, you see it now, a second dry dock coming up, but he's also looking at how to better organize the Navy. His views on the Marine Corps are pretty well known. You know, he came into it, think, in 1830 saying, I want to get rid of the Marine Corps. We're going to include them in the artillery and infantry units with the Army. What ends up happening is a very bifurcated argument among the senior officers, the senior Navy captains, because we didn't have admirals until the Civil War. Some of them are saying, yeah, this is a great thing to do. The other half are saying, no, they're the dregs of humanity and they're troublemakers. However, you need them on the ships. So don't get rid of them. what ends up happening, and Jackson agrees to this, is in 1834, he comes up with the Act for the Better Organization of the Marine Corps. What does it do? Number one, it puts the Marine Corps under the Department of the Navy. Now, that means that the Marines are now subject to the same regulations as Navy sailors and officers, which is important because when you look at the number of courts-martial per year, there's this dramatic spike in 1835. And when I realized that there was a spike, I was like, oh, okay, this makes sense. Most of them are Marines. And so basically they're winnowing out the bad Marines, if you will. It increases the size of the Marine Corps by 40%. It makes Archibald Henderson, the longest serving Marine Corps commandant, a full colonel. They didn't have generals back then. So these are just a couple of the important things. Now, there are other things that are not necessarily Jackson-driven, but that they happen under Jackson's administration. One of the things, for example, that the previous presidential administration had argued, about draining the swamp and finding people in senior positions who aren't tied to the swamp, Jackson didn't do that, especially with the Navy. The first person he picks is the Postmaster General. And then back then, the Postmaster General was one of the senior most cabinet level positions. It was very, very important. And he offers it to John McLean. McLean says, no, I'm not interested. And 3 days later becomes a Supreme Court justice. He picks in succession as his three secretaries of the Navy, John Branch, Levi Woodbury, and Mellon Dickerson. All three of them had served in the Senate. They'd all been governors. These were not people who were outside of, quote unquote, the swamp, if you will. These were people who were experienced executives. These were people who were experienced legislators who at least had access to Navy policy while they were serving. So I think that in total helps change our understanding of Jackson's view and his behavior. And we can talk about, there's one particular court martial I think is fundamental to understanding his administration. But yeah.
But I definitely want to get in on the legal stuff later on the show. But while you were talking about, who they appointed as a SecNav, one of the things that you read something and you go, God, I've completely forgotten that from years ago, is the U.S. Navy and what you're going to do with the funding was no small deal, because the Navy had a huge bite of the overall federal mm-hmm. government. And you outline, Jackson's three parts about the roles of the Navy, his grand strategy, so to speak. It was favorable trade, an expanded global presence, and how to conduct punitive expeditions, kind of a very 21st century policy in many ways. But the naval budget and the personnel costs, which were as it is now back then, was such a huge part of the federal budget. That made it pretty political, especially when you're dealing with that with the House and the Senate.
Absolutely. The federal budget at this time, when it takes over in 1829, is $17 million. And the defense budget the military budget is roughly half that. It's $9 million. And of that $9 million, the Navy had about $4 million to begin with. By 1836, it goes from 3.8 to 7.5 million. He is saying in his inaugural address, in his farewell address, in his annual addresses to Congress, nearly every year, we need a gradual increase to the Navy. We need a gradual increase to the Navy. Finally, by 1835, 36, he's saying, we're doing fine in our economy. This is exactly the time we should be expanding our Navy even more. Where does he put the money? And again, getting back to what Eagle One says, the first thing he does is have fiscal accountability. In order to do that, there were a lot of problems under the Quincy Adams administration. He brings in this for a patronage job, this guy, Amos Kendall, who had been a Jacksonian newspaper editor. And Kendall doesn't know anything about the Navy, but he's brought in as fourth auditor of the Department of the Treasury, because we didn't have a Navy comptroller at the time. We only had about 10 people working for the Navy. And so Kendall starts investigating all these improprieties, and they're able to save money. And Jackson says, okay, what we're going to do now is we're going to repair the ships that we need to. We're going to look at the ships that really can't make it, and there's really only a couple because they've been receiving ships for a number of years, or they were built quickly during the War of 1812 and the wood wasn't up to par. And so once he is able to get the infrastructure in place, once he's able to get the money in place, then he starts investing in more and more in the personnel, in sailors and the officers, increasing pay. By the time his administration is over, the salaries are not necessarily for individual sailors, but it's twice as much as it was when he started for the federal as part of the federal budget. He is building ships, but he recognizes that, you know, these big ships, these ships of the line, these first and second rate ships, we shouldn't be building them. We ended up only building one toward the end of his administration because of politics. I don't know if he knew this, but I'm pretty sure he did, because I started tracking the numbers of and in the dissertation research. The deployment rates for the ships of the line in this period was about 15 to 17% annually. The frigates was about 40%. The sloops and the schooners, 80 to 90%. These are the workhorses of the Navy that are comprising the majority of the squadrons. They allow you to do more things. And so when this debate comes up about building this 120-gun ship of the line USS Pennsylvania in 1835-1836, there's a strong debate in Congress because you have a lot of them saying, you know, the head of the some committees are saying, we don't need a ship this big. We can take the money for this USS Pennsylvania, and instead we can build 10 to 12 schooners and sloops and have broader range. The person who really wins on this debate is the chair of the Naval Affairs Committee, who happens to be the congressman from Philadelphia, where the Pennsylvania is being constructed. The Pennsylvania ends up being constructed, launched in 1837 after his administration is concluded, sails down to Norfolk, and there it remains as a receiving ship until 1861, where it's burned to the waterline. So I think we understand Jackson's use of the Navy, and when you look year to year, and I'm trying to get a better data visualization for this, but the map changes every year just like it does for the United States Navy. When we were talking a few years ago about pivot to the Pacific, you see one year where he's pivoting the squadron or more ships to a squadron off of Brazil to deal with Falklands. He's creating a squadron in the East Indies, and he supports the permanent stations that we already have in the Eastern Pacific, in the Mediterranean, the West Indies.
You know, you're talking about the small ship, big ship thing. I mean, there's so much in his history that parallels our current situation. I mean, infrastructure, mm-hmm. small ship, big ship, improving sailors' conditions. In addition to that, there was a ripening, I guess, of the intellectual development of naval officers and others who were writing, and not just Fenimore Cooper, but others writing about the Navy. Can you kind of discuss how that impacted kind of set the Navy up for the future?
I think this is one of the most important things that comes out of the 1830s. Master Commandant Matthew Perry, this is an equivalent to a lieutenant commander today, is at the Brooklyn Navy Yard, and he starts meeting with his junior officers who are assigned there every Monday afternoon in his office. And they're talking about affairs in the world and trying to become better officers. They end up founding this organization called the Naval Lyceum at the Brooklyn Navy Yard. Now, the Lyceum movement had been around for about a decade throughout the United States. It was part library, part museum, part lecture hall, part post office for the Navy. And it would last until 1888. And I'm more familiar with that because the Naval Academy Museum in 1892 inherits all of its collection. It's books on who were members, et cetera. But what ends up happening is they establish a naval magazine in 35, 36. It's only around for 8 issues, unfortunately. I don't know why it faded out, But it was this new movement in the 1830s of having more magazines because literacy rates went up. About 70% of free Americans were literate, and because of schools were developing now. And the second thing is the price of paper and publication went down dramatically. So you have this proliferation of military magazines, the Sailor's Journal, the Army and Navy Chronicle, and the Naval Magazine. And so junior officers are writing, and they're by and large writing under pseudonyms because sometimes they get into trouble even with what they're writing. So you see these debates emerging in the Naval Magazine, and they're the ones who are proposing we need a naval school because we're seeing the steam technology in England, and we can't study engineering and math to a degree that we need to on, especially on the sloops and schooners, because we don't have a schoolmaster. We need a central school where all of the midshipmen can learn the same courses in what's now known as STEM courses. It would take another decade, and it would take a very emotional issue with the mutiny on the Summers to really drive the policy to create a naval academy. But this is where it starts, and you start to, when you look at the letters of these midshipmen, there's one, Daniel McKay, who just struck me from the beginning, and seeing his words in letters to Samuel DuPont, who has one of the most extensive collections of letters. He's talking about these naval policies, like, hey, here's how we could use steam batteries. Here's what we need to do with naval policy, and I'm thinking of writing something greater on this. The letter in which he writes this is one of the last letters he'll write, because a month later he is lost with all the other crew of the USS Hornet off Tampico, Mexico. So in looking at a lot of the articles, not only in the Naval Magazine but in these letters, you get a sense that there's this new crop of junior officers who are, number one, willing to challenge the status quo. Number two, they're willing to come up with new ideas that, by and large, are right. I mean, they're talking about, hey, we need some sort of formal training for our petty officers. We need better pay for them. We need the school for us. We need to have better rank structures. We need to, you know, do this, this, and that. And so this is what I've always referred to as the first of the three periods of the JO movement in naval history. The second one right after the Civil War. The third one I think is started about a decade ago with CIMSEC, the Center for International Maritime Security, founded by junior officers. But what happens with each of these organizations, and I don't think it won't happen for a long time with CIMSEC, with the Naval Lyceum, you start to see the majority of their members in the 1830s and 40s are midshipmen and lieutenants. There are very few captains who are members. They end up having people like Stephen B. Luce, Alfred Thayer Mahon, who are members. How do we know this? Because I've looked into the membership records that we have at the United States Naval Academy Museum. But by the 1860s, 70s, 80s, the membership is, they are now part of the conservative thinking of the Navy. And the next time this happens, it again starts with junior officers and eventually becomes this becomes the decision makers, and they become that there's this gap again for junior officers. So that's why I think CIMSEC has really taken on this movement as they did in the 1830s. And that's why I think it's so important as part of this discussion.
That was one of the things I enjoyed about the book, is the fact that Jackson obviously is a topic and a central player, but he is a player in a larger moment. And he facilitated part of the moment, but he also kind of was in sync with the moment. And I figured I'd open the door a little bit if you wanted to talk a little bit, because there's some personalities here that matter. One of them you mentioned was Lieutenant Daniel McKay. There was also Commodore Barron, who again was an individual I never knew about, but an impactful gentleman to himself. But there are also other players. For instance, the reader might enjoy the fact that Edgar Allan Poe has two appearances. But there's also another group called the Knickerbocker Group, We had both individuals and groups of individuals who are grabbing hold of this idea of sea power. And even before the whole idea of manifest destiny, there was America and its maritime destiny. You know, talk a little bit about McKay, if you have a few more things you wanted to mention, Commodore Barons, and also the Knickerbocker Group, and how they helped get this conversation and movement going at a time that, you know, you have to remember most of this was done by letter, if you're lucky.
Yeah, that's true. Now, I'll go right to Barron. Barron had two incidents that really prevented him from being a more significant officer. He had been the first officer on the USS United States during the Quasi-War, in which some of the lieutenants and midshipmen were Charles Stewart, Stephen Decatur, Richard Summers. But in 1807, he's the senior officer on the Chesapeake when it is basically interceded by the Leopard. And so as a result, he's court-martialed. He's not able to serve in any capacity during the War of 1812. In 1820, this culminates with a duel in which he kills Stephen Decatur on the fields of Bladensburg. But in the 1830s, he's still an officer. I mean, it was tough to be drummed out as an officer. Most of them had been court-martialed. Decatur, Stewart, Barron, all of them were not only court-martialed, they were presidents of the court-martial of each other's court-martial or courts of inquiry. In the 1830s, Barron is commander of the Philadelphia Navy Yard, and he's working on patents. He realizes there's this new health movement, the new medicine, if you will, of the 1830s, driven by people like William Barton, who was a surgeon, Navy surgeon, and he says, hey, I'm going to write a book. I've written this book. He writes it in 1830. He says, we got to use lime and lemons to fight scurvy. We need the employment of female nurses to take care of our sailors and officers who are ill in the hospitals. But Barron has a patent for ventilation of the ships using a series of large bellows. And he has some other things. He develops a tri-hulled steam-powered ram ship. Basically, it had three hulls. Between the three hulls, you had two steam paddle wheels to protect them from enemy fire. And you would use it as a ram ship. Now, it was very close to being funded and constructed in 1835. It wasn't, because Congress ended up going with the Fulton II as they were preparing for that. And then you see ram ships later on in the riverine system during the Civil War. So he was a bit ahead of his time in that regard. But the Knickerbocker Group were largely based on the Hudson River, just north of New York City, places like Tarrytown, what's now known as Sleepy Hollow. And I mentioned the junior officers who were writing. They're writing for each other. So it's a bit of an echo chamber. They're not going to get a lot of traction. What they need is are individuals who can write from a popular standpoint. And they find this with the Knickerbocker Group, where you have people like, again, James Fenimore Cooper, who's writing for the Naval Magazine. Explicit ways about the ships and the rank structure, et cetera. You have Washington Irving as part of this, probably the first superstar when it comes to American literature. He had just come back from living in London and I think Paris and Spain. He had been a Navy clerk for a while. He was actually offered the position of Secretary of the Navy during Jackson's administration. Right after, for Van Buren. He turns it down. Ends up being James Kirk Paulding. And who's James Kirk Paulding? He is part of the Knickerbocker Group. So there are these serious literary figures who are writing about the Navy. And it's not just them. There was a minor novelist during the 1830s. His name was Joseph Hart, and that's where you mentioned his idea earlier. And he writes in this novel called Miriam Coffin that the oceans are America's great national destiny. When de Tocqueville writes his seminal work, Democracy in America, he writes pages and pages on the Army, but very little on the Navy. But it's so powerful in that one paragraph, because he says, America was born to rule the seas as Rome was destined to rule the ancient world. So a decade before this sense of manifest destiny is playing out on the plains and the Rockies and to the Pacific Ocean. You have this sense now developing in the 1830s that, no, it's the ocean where it needs to be. And in fact, in teaching my naval history class several years ago, I had my midshipmen develop their own challenge coin, and I used wood from the USS Constitution. I said, okay, you guys design it. You've got to come up with a logo, and you've got to come up with, you know, some verbiage. And they end up using an image of one of my then black labs on it. But for the words, it's Oceanum Vigilate, watch the ocean. It came down to that. And I think in the 1830s, because America had such a large merchant trade in the 1830s, it has now overtaken the British in terms of whaling in the Pacific, for example, that you need a navy to protect that. And when merchant ships go away, then the public with whom they are affiliated in with these merchant ships don't necessarily see the need for a navy, because in the 1830s, especially in New England, the merchant ships are personal to these people. They are the merchants. They are families of sailors and officers. And so they will understand why you need a navy. I don't think you have that today. There's no natural affinity that the American public have. And we say this time and again that, you know, it's only natural for us to be a maritime power. Why don't people understand this? We've had people giving lectures across the country, but the American public don't understand it as they did with the Navy and the merchant ship, the merchant marine in the 1830s.
It's not a long book, but it is dense in information. And one of the things that you got into, and we talked about a little bit here, is the riverine warfare. I just put up a blog post, a few weeks ago about riverine forces in Vietnam and some other aspects of it. They link back. They talk about riverine warfare starting with the Seminole Wars. But I don't think they really cover the extent that it went on for a long time. Can you kind of discuss the U.S. Navy involvement in the Seminole Wars and the riverine force?
Sure. December 28th, 1835, is the Dade Massacre. And as in a response, that basically kicks off the Second Seminole War. Now, the Seminoles have largely been contained, if you will, from an American perspective. They weren't necessarily a threat. People who lived in the general region thought that they were incursions on their property or whatever. But this Dade Massacre really is the one of the reasons why Jackson starts this war. And people don't realize this is nearly a 7-year military operation. It will end up costing as much, if not more, than the federal budget by, I think, the third or fourth year. I could be wrong on that. It's why you see the budget start to go up in 36, 37. Archibald Henderson is writing to his wife in May of 1836. And he says, oh, don't worry about this. I'm going down to deal with this, and I'll be back in 2 or 3 weeks. It'll be a short war. Don't worry about it. It ends up being 5 years more. But as part of that, because of the riverine system in Florida, you had two things happen. You had U.S. Navy warships, which were operating off of Florida, under the erroneous assumption that the Spanish were providing arms to the Seminoles. There was never any evidence of that. The second part of that is you had junior officers, Lieutenant McLaughlin is one of them, Lieutenant Levin Powell is another, who are given command of canoes, skiffs, small boats, small steamboats. And they are operating in basically conducting joint Army-Navy operations in riverine warfare. And these are, by the way, I should add, they and others like them, the junior officers of the 1830s, are those who will command ships, be commodores, and command stations during the Mexican-American War and the Civil War. And so they are learning their trade operating in these environments. So when you're talking about the riverine system and the Anaconda Plan during the Civil War, you almost really have to start at how did the U.S. Navy know how to operate as they did And it was largely because you had several years of these junior officers leading these essentially squadrons. And so that's why I think the Second Seminole War is important in understanding that aspect.
You know, I really wanted to show you, made an oblique reference to the Trump administration. And, you know, one of the things about the Trump administration, or specifically Trump as president, and the legal system was he got involved or said a few opinions about some court martials that went on. And it was, the numbers are incredible. When you look back at Jackson's administration, the level of his involvement in court martials, specifically naval court martials, is just simply hard to get the modern mind wrapped around. And again, it's a couple of the stories here you really wish somebody would do a miniseries about. But I also learned what tweaking somebody's nose means. But there was the case of Lieutenant Robert B. Randolph that is a combination of infuriating, shocking, and also very tragic. You know, just outline for a bit the norms of the early 1800s and a president getting involved in court martials, and some of the very dramatic and modern sounding issues revolving Lieutenant Randolph.
Sure. And just as part of that story, I was asked by the commanding officer of Camp David to go up a few years ago to populate the presidential lodge with some items from the Naval Academy Museum. And one of the things I recommended to him was an Asher Duran portrait we had of Andrew Jackson. And that was 2017. The president loved it. Apparently the first lady didn't. And so he took it and took it back to the Oval Office. So if you look at his first year in office at the Jackson portrait, it is different than what he had in his last 3 years. The one he had in his last 3 years belonged to the Naval Academy Museum. So I spent weeks and weeks and weeks reading through microfilm of 16,000 pages of 318 courts martial from 1828 to 1838. And I did a data analysis. So nobody really had gone through these court martial records. Somebody had written a book and just kind of hit a few highlights, but nobody had looked at what was happening. And what I realized is as I'm reading through each one, I start seeing these letters from Jackson. Well, with a court martial back then, only three people could approve, disapprove, or modify the results of a court martial: the commodore of the squadron, the secretary of the Navy, or the president of the United States. And I did a big data analysis, and I didn't include it in the book. It was part of my dissertation. I wish I'd been able to in some way. But what I started looking at all the courts martial from 1860. And what I found was Jackson was responding to twice as many courts martial on average than any of his predecessors or successors. And the numbers are truly astounding. And then there's this gap of about 2 years where he really only talks about one or two. And what happened was this Lieutenant Robert Randolph happened to be on the USS Constitution 1827-28. The purser, John Timberlake, dies in the Med. Randolph is made acting purser. And he doesn't know anything about being a purser. He'd been in the Navy for 15, 20 years. He was a warfighter, served in the War of 1812. And so he comes back, and during this time of fiscal responsibility, Amos Kendall says, well, where's this money? Where are these accounts? He tries to provide as much information as he can, given the circumstances. There's a court of inquiry. The court of inquiry exonerates Robert Randolph. But when it gets to Jackson, Jackson says, guilty, and drum him out of the Navy. Now, under a court of inquiry, he didn't have that power, but he did it anyway. So why was this, and why does Jackson take a dramatic pause for about 2 years? Well, John Timberlake, as people who've read about Jackson might remember his name, because he had a wife named Margaret, also known as, popularly known as Peggy in the 20th century. She becomes a widow at a very young age and marries the Secretary of War for Jackson, John Eaton. This is Margaret Eaton of the Eaton Affair, the Petticoat Affair. in which half of the administration resigns, including the Secretary of the Navy, because their wives have turned their backs on Margaret Eaton. And so I think, based on that, Jackson was beside himself on this whole Eaton affair. And I think he took it out with regard to the Navy on Robert Randolph, drums him out. As a result, Randolph doesn't know what to do. So Jackson is on this steamboat on the Potomac River. You know, they didn't have Secret Service back then. He walks onto the steamboat, and there's a question what he does. He either tweaks his nose or he punches Jackson. And Jackson, contrary again to what Remini says, doesn't take action against Randolph. Randolph escapes. There's so many newspaper accounts of this. It's pretty amazing. Washington Irving happens to be on the boat that night and recounts his involvement in the aftermath. But when Jackson leaves office, he writes a letter to Van Buren saying, if Robert Randolph ever wants to return to the Navy, please let him do so. So what I think, and what some of the Jacksonians have argued against, is I think he did what we wouldn't expect from Jackson. I think he felt remorse about what he did with Robert Randolph's career, and Randolph never becomes a naval officer again. He leads a very plain life. There's nothing really of note in the newspapers about his life after that. But I think that's really one of the most important things that comes out of the courts martial records in terms of personal stories.
Well, you kind of tipped on it. We don't have much time left, although we can take more time if you can come around. But you talked about the Summers incident. Can you kind of go through that? Because another one of these great stories of the time.
Sure. I'll summarize it because I don't cover much of it in the book. It's out of the period. But the 1842, Philip Spencer, the midshipman who had been kicked out of several colleges, a troublemaker, allegedly has plans to take over the brig Summers, one of the fastest ships in the fleet, and he and two sailors are hung. They're summarily told that they're guilty and hung by the commander of the ship, Alexander Slidell Mackenzie. Spencer is the son of the sitting Secretary of War. As a result, there's a court of inquiry, there's a court-martial, and there's a great public outcry about this, and that because there's a public outcry, there is congressional response. And the members of Congress say, well, clearly we need to teach our midshipmen about morals and ethics, so we're going to create, you know, we support Bancroft's idea for a naval academy. And this is, again, a few years later. So, again, I think it's important to understand that the officers, the junior officers of the 30s, wanted a school for practical purposes on how to improve the Navy. Congress and the public were responding to a very emotional thing and saying that we need leadership and ethics. And so that is why the school ends up being created, not necessarily the reason it was initially proposed by the officers.
Hey, Claude, as we wind things up, and before you go, you got to tell everybody what you've been working on, but I'll let my co-host remind you of that. One thing I noticed in your book, and this is, and maybe it's been going on longer than this, I don't know, but especially in the last 10 years, it's not something that's creeped up in the last year or two, but there are a lot of historians like yourself who will publish a book about a period of time, 150, 250, heck, a couple thousand years ago, and in the introduction or at the end or a couple times in the middle, you'll almost find in some cases it's wedged in kind of awkwardly, but it's not in your case. In the introduction, you mentioned a little bit about the fact that there are issues as a man of his time during the Jacksonian era related to Native Americans, to African Americans, slavery, et cetera, and so forth. And there's some pressure in the publishing arena, especially about history, to try to wedge in kind of modern socio-political issues into what is, in many cases, very focused histories. You know, talk a bit about the publishing process and what new historians or new authors, you know, may need to be prepared to answer and address and perhaps work around that process in today's environment, which can be very touchy.
Sure. Yeah, actually, that's one of the reasons why this book took so long to get released. It went through the first two reviewers, and for those of you who are not aware, when you submit a book to an academic publisher, it's peer-reviewed. There's usually reviewer A, reviewer B, and then, you know, you publish or you don't publish. Well, both reviewer A and reviewer B said, hey, great, I'd love to have this on my bookshelf. Here's a few minor things, correct them. It went to the editorial board at UA Press, and I want to say my editor at UA Press was awesome. He's just been great to work with throughout this process. The book series editor, the book series coordinator is extraordinary. But it went to this panel, and they said, well, we don't like the title, and oh, by the way, the author doesn't address how Jackson treated the Native Americans, and he doesn't address how he treated African Americans, and that's the reason why we can't publish. And, you know, to his credit, my editor said, do you understand this is about the Navy? And so they forced on this reviewer C and reviewer D, and so I went through another, I think, 9 or 10 months through this process, and I had to respond to them. I said, look, this is a book about the Navy. If you want books about, and there are tons of books about Native Americans. I am not trying to minimize what Jackson did to Native Americans. He had a plantation and at his home. I'm not minimizing that. That wasn't the focus of my book. My focus was on the Navy because nobody's really written a book about the Navy, whereas people have written books about these other subjects that were also very important, just as people have written books about the Second Bank of the United States or the Eaton Affair, et cetera. And so finally, they qualified it, said, you need to address these issues in your book. I did. But it made the process much longer than I expected. Again, it's not to minimize those issues. And I say in the book, there, if you go to one of these conferences like the Shear Conference or NASA or anybody else, you will find these new young historians who are exploring new and different ways of looking at historical issues. They're doing it. I don't need to. What I need to do is what they're not doing and what my predecessors haven't done. I needed to write about the Navy. There were some peripheral issues in the book with regard to Native Americans and African Americans, and I addressed those, and I addressed them earlier in an earlier version as well. But that made the publishing process much more difficult than it ever should have been. Again, my editor and the series coordinator, absolutely fantastic. They went to the mat for me because they believed in the book, and I couldn't be happy with them. But this is the new environment that I think historians need to understand. It's not good. It's not bad. It just is what it is. And you need to adapt to it and understand it. And I just went my own way because nobody else was writing about the Navy during this period. If they wanted me to write about a book about something else, I would have either written the book about something else or I wouldn't, because I'm a naval historian. I'm not a historian of other subjects, sometimes politics. But anyway, that's the long and the short of it, Sal.
Well, all that being said, and you and Sal and I could probably sit around and shoot the breeze for weeks, but we don't have that much time. So let me ask you the question that Sal teed up for me. What are you working on now? When will we see it? What's it look like? And what's got your interest at the moment?
Sure. I'm really excited that this fall my third Connor Stark novel will finally come out. It's funny because I started my dissertation around 2009, and I wrote, I think, two or three nonfiction books and a couple of novels. And when the second novel came out, John Gooch, who was my dissertation advisor from the University of Leeds, and since this is a podcast, I can say it, he just turned to me and said, Claude, you will stop writing your goddamn novels and write the dissertation. I said, okay, John, I promise I won't write another novel until I write my dissertation. So my third novel will come out this fall from Sunbury Press, my new publisher. And in fact, they're reissuing revised second editions of my first two novels, which are going to be renamed. I've done the revisions for those already. I've started sketching out my fourth novel, and I've started sketching out a couple of potential naval history books in ways that we haven't looked at the Navy before, hopefully. So those are the big things that I'm working on with regard to writing.
Well, Claude, as always, you are a content producer on high order, and it's just been a pleasure to have you back on Midrats here for an hour. And if everybody, Claude, if you're a Twitter person, Claude is up on Twitter. You can catch him there as well. And he's a good PR person, so if he's producing something, you'll be seeing it there. And just look forward to having the next opportunity to talk to you, Claude. Thank you very much for giving us an hour. I appreciate it.
Hey, thanks so much, guys. I really appreciate it. And again, I truly appreciate what you guys do every week to try to help people understand the Navy, Marine Corps, and the Maritime Services and the Merchant Service. So thank you.
It's been great, Claude. Thank you.
And thank you, everybody, for joining us for another edition of Midrats. Until next time, I hope you have a great Navy day. Cheers.
Piccadilly.